This is my opportunity to tell you something about something I know about, unlike perhaps the first talk, and actually tell you some of the work I've been doing over the last couple of years, and how that, and more generally, put that in the context of how maybe our ideas, we're developing a slightly broader range of ideas to tackle the question of where the structure in the universe came from. But this is still, I should say, within a fairly standard context of inflation in the very early universe, so accelerated expansion in the very early universe that I'm going to be talking about, how you produce structure from these models. In fact, I wondered whether I should have dropped the alternative word in the title. It's a bit of off-putting. It maybe sometimes sounds like not to be taken too seriously. I want to emphasize that these are actually fairly minimal models of producing structure in the universe. So scenarios for the origin of structure. And there are three scenarios I want to talk about. You see, they're not all alternative. The standard one I will introduce. But I want to persuade you that this is just one possibility. But it's become very much the standard model for the origin of structure. It's the inflaton scenario, where fluctuations in an inflaton field directly produce the large-scale structure of the universe. But there are other possibilities, and the two that have been attracted attention in the last couple of years specifically is one, which David Lyth and I gave the name, the curvaton scenario. Now, the prehistory of this, I think, can probably be traced back to a paper in 1990 of Sylvia Molerach, and also Andrei Linde and Slava Mukhanov mentioned this possibility in a paper about in the mid-90s. But the real impetus was given to the discussions of these ideas a couple of years ago. First of all, there's a paper of Carrie Enquist and Sloth, and I should say these papers are all on HEP PH from a couple of years ago. They actually applied this scenario in a pre-Big Bang context. So this was an alternative model for the very early universe and a way to try and get structure out of collapse-type models. But David Lyth and I were working on the same idea in the context of standard inflation models about the same time. And as well, the Japanese group, Moroi and Takahashi, again, put forward the same idea at basically the same time. So it was obviously an idea that whose time had come. And then this year, there's been attention on related models, which I'll put under the general heading of modulated reheating. So there's a paper of Tavali, Gruzinov, and Zal Dariaga, and Lev Kaufman about the same time in, I think it's February or March of this year. And these ideas are still being worked on. So I think Shamit has a paper, is it today or in the last few days on the web, with Diwali exploiting again this kind of model for the origin of structure. So what's happening is people are investigating models of inflation that may not work as in the inflaton context. They don't produce structure through the standard inflaton mechanism. But you consider the physics of the model, you may see that it acts as you have a curvaton type mechanism or a modulated reheating to produce the large scale density perturbations after inflation. So I will try and explain to you how that happens. But the sort of zero point for all this is that I'm going to be discussing models of inflation, accelerated expansion in the early universe. So the basic origin of structure in these models is always going to be zero-point quantum fluctuations of some scalar field during inflation, which gets stretched up to large scales by the expansion. So in all cases, I'm thinking of quantum fluctuations during inflation in the very early universe, so that starting from small scales, where we have some underdamped oscillations, basically the free oscillations of some scalar field, some zero-point oscillations, scale factor in here as well, those get stretched up to large scales, and on large scales you get some overdamped, they go from an underdamped regime into an overdamped regime, and the amplitude of the growing mode solution on large scales, calculated in terms of quantities at horizon crossing, you basically integrate up the zero-point fluctuations up to the Hubble scale, and you get fluctuations, the sort of classic result, h over 2 pi. So these are fluctuations for a light scalar field in an inflating universe.
What's the status of identifying the scalar field in the string theory, or some other fundamental
theory? Well, the curvaton is... So what I'm going to talk about today is mainly the classical... Start taking a scalar field with this distribution of perturbations on large scales and seeing how general relativity, sort of particle physics plus general relativity, turns that into a real density perturbation in the radiation. I'll sort of come back to the question of... I'll say a little bit about how you look for candidates and trying to identify these candidates. I'm not really going to identify the candidates in terms of string theory fields. The curvaton is an example of sort of... The curvaton is really an example where, for instance, there's been a lot of work identifying it with standard or minimal extensions of the standard model of particle physics in a way that has proved difficult traditionally for the inflaton field. That's an important issue, but it's not really one I'm going to particularly focus on today.
There's no danger, there isn't any such scalar field.
There are no scalar fields. Well, or there's no... I mean, there are plenty of scalar... So there are plenty of scalar modes, but whether they have the right properties is an issue in model building, but not one that I'm particularly... I just want to really discuss... That's right. The connection with the string theory building of... This may be more sophisticated in a sense than is... going through all these possibilities may be a bit beyond where string theory is at the moment in terms of coming up with candidates. I mean, most of the work basically focuses... is still a sort of... The question being addressed is, can you find an inflaton? This is going perhaps a bit further now in terms of looking for... actually broadening the range of possibilities. So I want to introduce this to the audience here, partly to say that, there may be other routes you could go in terms of model building, but I'm not going to get into identifying the string theory origin of these fields particularly. So this is the basic starting point, and the point I suppose I need to emphasize, just this applies for any light scalar field, which means, specifically, that its mass is less than the Hubble scale during inflation.
Can you remind us of the remedial that k goes up to what?
How far do you want to go? Up to the Planck scale? I mean, so it starts...
What do you need?
I'm assuming that all modes within the Hubble scale are in this vacuum state. Now, whether you really extrapolate that down below the Planck scale is the sort of question that has been investigated. That's the sort of as the trans-Planckian problem. I'm just taking the minimal assumption that they are in their vacuum state, say from the Planck scale up to about the Hubble scale, at which point they start feeling the expansion of the universe.
So you don't actually need to know anything beyond this problem? No. Well...
When they are at the Planck scale, which could in principle depend on what they were doing.
That's right.
When they were the Planck scale.
So I'm just making the standard assumption that they sit in their vacuum state whenever I can talk about them as a above the Planck scale.
David, perhaps there should be an exit index on the left right-hand side?
Yes.
The instantaneous H, right?
That's right. So you... yeah, so this is working out the amplitude of the field fluctuations at horizon crossing, which I'll generally stick a star on to denote the epoch when k equals ah.
But if you don't put any black boxes in the story, mm-hmm. claim ignorance about what's happening on very short scales, then indeed you would be saying, generally, that the modes on extremely short scales were in the standard vacuum state, even if the scale is much higher than the point.
Yes, that's right. If you extrapolate it, that's what... you extrapolate back towards, you know. Okay, so that's the zero point. So how does that get used in the standard inflaton scenario? Well, this is the minimal scenario in the sense that slow roll models of inflation are based on the expansion history of the universe being driven by a light scalar field. So it has fluctuations. If I swap to sigma for my inflaton field. So now sigma, the inflaton field, has fluctuations at horizon crossing, h over 2 pi. Now, of course, and then what you have to do is you have to make a connection between fluctuations in some unidentified scalar field driving inflation with the subsequent density perturbations during radiation, matter-dominated, when the universe is made of ordinary stuff that we observe today. Now, so for instance, what you don't do is you don't just calculate delta rho over rho, the fractional density perturbation during inflation. If you did, calculating delta rho over rho at horizon crossing for these field fluctuations, you just end up calculating the derivative of the potential times delta sigma over V at horizon crossing. That is not what you actually see after inflation. So for instance, this means that when André is talking about stochastic inflation models where there's a large quantum fluctuations of the field relative to the classical ones, you don't actually get large density perturbations at Hubble crossing during inflation, they can still be very small. But they can produce large fluctuations after inflation because delta rho over rho after inflation is not calculated from delta rho over rho at horizon crossing, but this formula, delta rho over h rho dot, at horizon crossing. And the reason you work out that is because this is the geometrical curvature perturbation produced by the inflaton field fluctuations during inflation. So this is a geometrical perturbation, a dimensionless curvature perturbation. Yeah, so let me, so that's what the first thing I'm going to try and do. So the reason you calculate this, emphasize this geometrical picture. R here, which is also often called, is very closely related to something called zeta. This is the curvature perturbation on a specific set of hypersurfaces. It's the uniform field, which is closely related to the uniform density hypersurfaces, so the idea here is that if you split, let's do a sketch of space-time, where in the Robertson-Walker homogeneous space-time, you've got homogeneous spatial hypersurfaces, T1, T2, and the fields are just uniform on these, and world lines evolving time forward along the world lines of the co-moving observers, you see a nice spatially homogeneous universe. Well, now, you've got field perturbations, and if you use the matter contents, which during inflation is the scalar field, so these would be the uniform field hypersurfaces, they have a curvature. And what you've done here is calculate the curvature of those uniform field, or effectively uniform density hypersurfaces during inflation.
Is this three curvature?
So this is, yes, this is three curvature, that's right, the spatial curvature.
So that's the gauge invariant quantity.
That's the gauge invariant quantity.
Do that during inflation also?
So this is what I've calculated at horizon crossing during inflation. So maybe I've during inflation, probably I should have really written this as what the thing you actually tend to calculate during inflation is in terms of the field. But I'm going to, in slow roll, they're the same. That determines the energy density. So what you've calculated is something in terms of the quantities during inflation, but it's something which is you can then relate to the late time distribution of energy density after inflation. So in terms of the pictorial reason why you can think of it as just being a consequence of because it's a geometrical quantity, at least at the minimum, it's a quantity you can identify both during inflation and after inflation. It's the curvature of the uniform energy density hypersurfaces. That has a meaning right through from inflation through reheating on afterwards. To show why it's conserved, remains constant on large scales and hence is a useful quantity, well, it's been known about probably for 20-odd years that this is a good quantity to work with. I want to work over here. Let me give you a simple I've been working on it for some years. I think this is the simplest way of giving a demonstration of why this quantity is a useful quantity that's conserved. And it's a work I've done just recently with David Lyth again. So these are the question of why do you get these quantities that are conserved quantities, perturbations on large scales. Which is on the web a couple of months ago. Well, it's actually, you always get conserved quantities if you have some quantity X that obeys a conservation equation. Of the following form, so that the rate of change of x with the expansion of the universe. Now here I'm using n, which is the sort of logarithm of the expansion. So in terms of, you can write this in terms of the time derivative as the Hubble rate h to the minus 1 times dx by dt. So if that is just some function of the local value of x, then you will always get a conserved quantity that is just the local perturbation in the expansion delta n. So if you have a local conservation equation, then there exists a conserved perturbation. Let's call it zeta of x, which is simply delta x over y of x, and there are some sort of caveats to make sure you've done this carefully. First of all, let me say delta x is obviously the difference between x evaluated at two points on a particular spatial hypersurface. So on spatial hypersurfaces separated by uniform expansion. So let me try and draw that picture of what I'm on about here. So the idea is that this is, so now if you have an equation that for the evolution of X that looks like this locally, so it's, so in think about an expanding cosmology, you don't, the conservation of X doesn't mean that it's constant, it means that it's covariantly conserved, so it's diluted by the expansion, and you've got a simple law that X dot is the Hubble rate times some function of the local value of X, then if I construct hypersurfaces, spatial hypersurfaces, such that, so, well, first of all, I think of world line A and world line B co-moving with X, and then so that defines my spatial coordinates, and then I pick spatial slices, so constant time slices separated by uniform integrated expansion. So this is N1, N2. So the expansion is the integral of h dt from 1 to 2. Then that's the expansion along there. And if it's the same between here and here as it is between here and here, then I basically can construct this quantity such that it's conserved. So let me try and... So the idea is delta n is the integral from n1, it's just the difference between n1 and n2, okay? But if I've got this kind of expansion law, I can rewrite that in terms of the local quantities dx over y of x, and I integrate that from x along A at time 1 and up to time 2, xA2, and that has to be the same by construction as the integral from xB1 to xB2 and then basically I rearrange my integration limits here to get an integral from xA1 to xB1, take that one up there and take that limit down there. So to first order, I can just say that this integral is delta x over y of x at time 1, and that has to equal delta x over y of x at time 2. This is actually just doing this, getting the first order result. But the fact that you've got a conserved quantity actually isn't a linear result. It works, so this gives you a result for the nonlinear perturbations as well. So it's quite a powerful way of dealing with perturbations if you have a quantity here that is a local. So there are some caveats as to how, when you can use this, but basically it works well for large-scale cosmological perturbations. So you've got a local continuity equation, and you can construct these hypersurfaces that are separated by uniform expansion. For instance, uniform curvature, spatial curvature hypersurfaces will do the job. So,
is that an accepted equation?
Delta x has to be evaluated on these hypersurfaces, actually. So, so this is sort of hidden in the statement that I've constructed these hypersurfaces separated by uniform expansion. But it's, as I say, you then have to go away and work out, well, what are useful hypersurfaces? And in first-order perturbation theory, for instance, working with the spatially flat hypersurfaces will do nicely, and you work out delta x on a uniform spatial curvature hypersurface. And that's actually also turns out to be useful because if I've left up the work about quantum fluctuations, the variable you in the linear theory, you quantize these fluctuations, they're actually the field fluctuations on the uniform curvature hypersurfaces. So this is the Mukhanov variable, which is used when people want to actually work with gauge invariant perturbations. Yes, Lam?
Is the curvature perturbation constant beyond first order?
Yes, you can construct something, this quantity that's, and I've given the, in a paper with Karim Malik in the last couple of months, I've given the second order gauge invariant expression for the thing that's conserved on, you know, there's a large scale limit you have to take to actually get it to be conserved. Right, so I don't know how enlightening all that is, but I just wanted to get across the point that you can construct this such perturbations whenever you've got a conserved quantity. And that's actually, well, the first example to give then is the one that's used in the inflaton scenario, which is when you have an adiabatic density perturbation. Now, delta rho. So here we construct a quantity zeta for the density, which is delta rho over, well, this is y of x is basically h to the minus 1 rho dot. So you just calculate that on large scales, and that's the quantity that's conserved in the inflaton scenario. That is conserved, constant on large scales. So there's a if this y of x is just a function of the local density. Now, what I should really have written down is to remind you the continuity equation for the local continuity equation for the energy density. Minus 3h rho plus p. So this is conserved if p obeys a definite equation of state along all the different world lines, all the perturbed world lines in the universe. And that's true if you have, one can take that as a definition of an adiabatic density perturbation, that delta p is simply p dot over rho dot times delta rho. So we have a conserved quantity, but we have to have a unique equation of states along all the different perturbed world lines. But so what we've realized recently is that there may be other cases where you have conserved local continuity equation where you can calculate a conserved quantity. And so for instance, so we can think of different examples, but a nice example in the early universe might be conservation of, say, baryon number. At least after some point in the history of the universe, baryon number will be conserved. So you can construct, so you've got evolution equation for the baryon number, which if it's conserved will just be, it's just diluted by the expansion. So this is my function y of x, and I can construct a conserved quantity zeta for the baryon perturbation, which is delta n for the baryon number, delta nb over nb, which will be conserved on large scales in the universe. So, there are other shortcuts to calculating perturbations of quantities that are conserved. I suppose I should include my factor of 3 there. And there may be other lepton number. So, you know, you can actually investigate perturbations in particular scenarios without actually having to do the hard work of evolving the density perturbations necessarily. This gives you a shortcut to calculate some of the perturbations relating high energy physics, you know, very early universe quantities to observable quantities like the photon to baryon ratio in the universe at late times. So this is why you calculate this quantity during inflation in the inflaton scenario, because during inflation you go into a single field inflation, I should say, you go into a squeezed state. There's an attractor in phase space which tells you that there is the perturbations are adiabatic, P is a unique function of rho, and then that quantity, regardless really of the physics, the subsequent evolution, this quantity is conserved on large scales. It just follows from the local, as long as energy is locally conserved. So that's a very powerful result. So powerful that it's probably been oversold in the sense that it makes you think that in any cosmological scenario, all you have to do is calculate this H delta rho over rho dot. Indeed, there's a sort of been a misconception, I think, that you can't change the curvature perturbation on large scales. And the argument is often based around the notion that causality tells you, should tell you that somehow you can't move the density in the universe, shift density around on large scales in the universe, so you can't change this curvature perturbation, H delta rho over rho dot, on scales beyond the horizon or beyond the Hubble scale. So this is a sort of misunderstanding, so I haven't written it down. Let me cross it out. Because it's only true if you have this adiabatic, or if you have an equation of state, so the adiabatic condition on the perturbations. And if you actually look at, you can use this, the continuity equation to actually work out what the change in the curvature perturbation is. And you find that, in fact, R dot can change if you've got a non-adiabatic pressure perturbation, which can survive on large scales, where delta B NAD has some gauge invariant definition. It's the so you can sort of check that if P is a unique function of rho, this must vanish. So the picture here, the way this works, I think, is if you now think about what's going on in phase space, say, where you look at the local pressure and density, I think it's useful to think about adiabatic and non-adiabatic perturbations as being perturbations relative to the trajectory of the homogeneous background. So you've got some homogeneous background solution. So this is the zeroth order background solution, which traces out some evolution in the phase space, P versus rho, as the universe expands. And in general, you can have perturbations about wherever the classical solution is, you have perturbations, and you've got at least two modes of perturbation, one along the trajectory and one orthogonal to the trajectory. So the one along the trajectory is the adiabatic mode. And this, for instance, is described by the curvature perturbation. It tells you basically how much you've perturbed delta rho backwards or forwards along that trajectory. But of course, you also get, in general, you can have orthogonal trajectories. That's probably where few of you can see where I'm writing. So generically, one can call these entropy perturbations, typically described by use the character S for the entropy perturbations. An example being, if you've got a photon baryon fluid, you can have perturbations in the total density, or you can have perturbations in the photon to baryon number. In different patches of the universe will then follow different trajectories. So you can, in a sense, so it's the fact that you've not got a unique equation of state that you can have a non-adiabatic, allows you to have a non-adiabatic pressure perturbation, and that the fact that P, the pressure is different in different along different world lines, can produce a density perturbation subsequently, even if you had a uniform density hypersurface here of zero curvature, So no curvature perturbation on those hypersurfaces initially. If the pressure is different here and here, the expansion history to the next uniform expansion hypersurface would be different. So if you go to a uniform expansion, the pressure will mean that the resulting density is different here and here. So in very general terms, leave that picture there. So for the general evolution on large scales, you could describe it by saying that the curvature and entropy perturbation at late times is generally some matrix relating it to the curvature and entropy perturbation, say, when fields are crossing the horizon during inflation. Now, two of these elements in the matrix, transfer matrix, you can write down from the argument that R is constant on large scales. You get that if there's no entropy, then R equals R star. Also, from this sort of general argument, you can see that if you start off on the with a perturbation on the trajectory, you stay on the trajectory. But beyond that, there are two parameters which are really depend on the physics of how scalar field fluctuations turn into matter fluctuations. And these have to really be worked out. So this is basically telling you how some orthogonal perturbation to the inflaton trajectory during inflation, how it turns up, how it feeds into the late-time curvature, or indeed the late-time isocurvature perturbation, is in general going to be physics dependent. But in principle, you can produce a late-time curvature perturbation if TRS is non-zero from isocurvature perturbations at horizon crossing during inflation. And these two models here fall into that last category, where you assume that actually the dominant contribution to the late-time curvature could come from something that's actually isocurvature or entropy perturbations off the trajectory during inflation. So that's the very general discussion. And then the two examples to give, really, of the curvaton model. And I'll get around, I hope, to saying something about the modulated reheating model as well, just to sketch out, in general terms, how this works. So let me tell you about so what's the curvaton supposed to be? Having established that I think this is possible in principle, what sort of physics might actually make this effect relevant? Well, the curvaton is basically supposed to be just a late decaying scalar. The sort of scalar field that's been discussed in inflation, often in the context of the moduli problem, in cosmology, it's not necessarily so there's a moduli problem with stabilizing moduli or whatever in string theory. In cosmology, the problem here is that if you've got weakly coupled scalars, they can come to dominate the energy density of the universe after inflation. And so suppose after inflation, we've got a, let's call this late decaying scalar chi. Suppose after inflation, this has some vacuum expectation value, indeed non-zero vacuum expectation value, then even if rho chi, which will basically be m squared chi squared, let's take to be m squared chi squared anyway, even if this is much less than the radiation density after inflation, it grows. It can grow relative to radiation. So if it's frozen in, the vacuum energy, the energy of the chi field remains basically constant. we look at how energy densities evolve, say log rho goes to the log of the scale factor, say, then the radiation density is decreasing. While H is, while it stays massless, the field's effectively frozen in, its energy density remains constant. Once H equals M, the field starts oscillating, but it still only evolves like A to the minus 3. It's just diluted by the energy, by the expansion, whereas radiation is dying away like A to the minus 4. So the moduli tend to dominate, and the only way out of that is that this must decay before nuclear synthesis.
Can I just relate to the beginning of Andre's talk where he argued that in some circumstances you oscillate less than you might know you're making, and you can drop down to the minimum factor because it's going to evolve or whatever?
Well, I'm just talking about the classical evolution. And Dre was talking about jumps, stochastic jumps from the quantum fluctuations. So you could calculate, for instance, the probability of jumping here, I think. But at this stage, I'm just thinking of the average evolution.
There's no tachyonic mass.
Well, you have moduli with a complicated potential, and they could drop into different minima with domain walls between them.
At this stage, I'm just considering the simplest case. So, I mean, you could...
If they can drop into different minima, then the situation will be much worse. Because then the main wall energy will decrease much smaller, and the spring more slow than A to the minus 3.
Yeah. I mean, so there are all sorts of actual constraints you have to worry about if you have a given potential. But this is like doing the m squared phi squared chaotic inflation at the moment. I've just got m squared chi squared for my curvaton, and I'm just thinking about the simplest dynamics at the moment. So, well, at the moment it's not a curvaton, it's just a late decaying scalar. And I'm just repeating what's sort of almost textbook cosmology now of if you have late decaying scalars, they better decay. And if it's very weakly coupled, it might only decay with a gravitational strength decay. Maybe if I parameterize that, put in some dimensionless parameter beta. Then, so when it decays, you get the energy density in the chi field turns into radiation. This is an example of late entropy release, which in this context, entropy means production of photons. Particles, which are thermalized in the early universe, but it had better happen before nuclear synthesis. So you get some constraints on the mass of the moduli being bigger than about 10 or 100 TeV, depending on the value of the actual decay rate. Okay, so this is just picking up a bit of physics that was lying around and discussed in terms of the background, what the sort of average background cosmology was doing. But if you now consider fluctuations in the chi field, so to make it a curvaton, you're interested in the case where the fluctuations of this are interesting. So I'm assuming that M is less than H, as I was in the standard moduli case, M less than H during inflation, so that it has fluctuations given by H over 2 pi at horizon crossing during inflation. So you've got some primordial spectrum, almost scale invariant, being set up during inflation. So this is during inflation, after inflation, the Hubble rate decreases. And once m is bigger than h, chi oscillates. You can if you can neglect its energy transfer, you can construct a conserved quantity. Let's call it zeta chi, which is the density perturbation in chi on large scales, constructed in the way I was saying earlier. But this is basically for an oscillating scalar field. It's delta chi over chi. But okay, this is constant, at least while we neglect the interactions of chi. So you've got a two-fluid model of the early universe, and the total curvature perturbation is not going to be constant in general because of these fluctuations in chi are effectively non-adiabatic pressure fluctuations. The total curvature perturbation you can write actually as a weighted sum of curvature perturbation in chi compared with that in the radiation, where the weights just follow from the rho dot in the radiation relative to the total, and rho dot in the chi field relative to the total. So this is how you can use conserved quantities to follow the evolution of the total curvature perturbation, which is now a sum of two parts. And the curvetone scenario is the scenario where the effect of the curvetone dominates. So after decay, so this term will grow basically as the density of the chi field grows relative to the total until the decay time. So the resulting curvature perturbation is roughly given by omega, the fractional density perturbation in the chi field at the decay time, times delta rho, delta chi over chi, times the curvetone perturbation. So curvetone is just meant to be a simple example of how non-adiabatic fluctuations in a chi field, in the field like chi, can source density perturbations on large scales after inflation. No, in fact, it's the other way around. It wants to be generated after the decay.
But if you had a large excess before?
So if you had a large excess before,
then gamma over 1.
Well, it's so it gets diluted. So you're thinking about the fact it gets diluted by the late entropy release. So that's yes. So it would change, and it does. There's interesting consequences of that. And when we proposed this scenario, it was actually quite a nice possibility that the baryons would decay. The baryon number would be produced before the curvetone decayed, because there would be a nice signal, observational signal here. Because the final entropy, so when observers go and measure isocurvature perturbations or entropy perturbations, they're really talking about perturbations in the photon to baryon ratio. And now you can rewrite that in terms of conserved quantities as being a factor of 3, but then zeta constructed for the photons, the difference between zeta for the photons and zeta for the baryons. And if the zeta from the photons comes from the curveton, in the way I've suggested, it's omega at decay time times, zeta in the curveton. But this one was inherited from the earlier epoch, from when there was effectively no perturbation, then this becomes just a 3 zeta gamma. Well, let me write now. Can I extract what I want? So you end up with a non-zero isocurvature perturbation afterwards, omega theta chi. Whereas, and you can relate that to the total curvature perturbation, which is just this. So you have a relation between two observable quantities, and the factor is 3. They're of the same, so it's a nice example where the isocurvature and curvature perturbations are of the same order of magnitude. 2 years ago, that was allowed by the data, and unfortunately, it's killed by WMAP or just a bit before. But you end up, yeah.
Does that mean in these scenarios, therefore, you need to have late?
So you need the curvaton to decay after before the baryon number. So the baryon number either has to be set up so that basically these two are equal if it's set up after the decay. Or the interesting possibility, of course, is maybe you can consider models where the baryon number is produced by the curvaton decay. It's an out of equilibrium decay at late times. Yes, Gary.
So the curvaton presumably doesn't decay all at once. There's fluctuations in the decay time as well. Does that matter?
Well, so the simplest thing is simplest case would be just to put in one decay time for the curvaton. Now, if you want to think about its couplings to other fields, then yes, I mean, there might be more complicated models where you put that in. But I mean, it's like, in fact, we'll come to the modulated reheating model, which is exactly what people have done. They've put in a variation in the decay time, but at this stage, people are thinking about variation in the inflaton decay time.
You could consider a combination of 2 and 3 where everything.
Yeah. So these are all possibilities, but then...
I guess I'm asking a simpler question.
Yeah.
Even if there's no other decay channels, no other fields, I mean, it's still a probabilistic process, right? You have a mean lifetime.
Oh, right. So there's some random...
At the mean lifetime, you know, some things decay faster, some things...
Yeah, I think on large scales, that sort of shot noise is just not relevant. Yeah, you're talking about the entropy is large, there are large numbers of particles involved in this, so the average... Yeah, I mean, I haven't done the calculations, but I think it's a small scale effect. It is relevant on some scale. Okay. So there's a nice model, which I could go through of curvaton as a pseudo-Nambo-Goldstein boson, the classic thing. If you want a weakly coupled field with a flat potential, and it actually works out nicely that the sort of terms in terms of getting the curvaton contributing to the energy density before it decays. There's lots of physics you have to get right in the sense that, you know, you now have this combination which has to have the right amplitude, it has to decay before nuclear synthesis, you have to avoid having domain walls being produced between the different vacuum states. So there's lots of interesting physics to do. But the constraints are different from the inflaton scenario. And that's why just because it's a new idea to play with in terms of building models of inflation connected to density perturbations at late times, there's been a lot of activity here from people interested in model building, particularly in the context of sort of minimal extensions of the standard supersymmetric model. You can consider, so for instance, candidate models involved linked in with baryon decay would be neutrino models involving leptogenesis models of the origin of the baryon number. So these are models that have been talked about before we propose the curvaton mechanism, but once you start thinking about this as a possibility, you can actually look at model building. And so there's been a bit of a renaissance in terms of building models of inflation that are actually linked with the minimal extensions of standard model. And on the other hand, the other reason for having interest in this is that if you're interested in models of inflation and predictions of models of inflation, suddenly you have new constraints to play with, new constraints to impose on the model. And the third thing I want to say about the curvaton, I suppose, is then the link to observations. If you can calculate quantities like the curvature to isocurvature ratio, these are quantities that are being measured with increasing accuracy by large-scale structure surveys, microwave background experiments. There's, as well as the isocurvature, calculation of isocurvature amplitudes, you can calculate non-Gaussianity in these models in a simple way, which actually turns out to be the same simple model that the observers used to test Gaussianity of the model. So the WMAP data, when they first tried non-Gaussianity, it turns out to be exactly the right parameter to relate it to our theoretical parameters in the curvaton model. So there's lots of interest. And so shall I don't want to go on too far. I'll give you a quick non-Gaussianity is there's a very simple sketch of what's being constrained and why it's the physical quantity it's related to in this model. So this one of the simplest ways to think of non-Gaussianity to constrain is to look at fluctuations in the density, which are come from a first order bit that's Gaussian and a second order bit. And this is, which is maybe the square of a Gaussian. And this is, so if you think of density perturbations, the sort of second order density perturbations being composed of a Gaussian and the square of a Gaussian, then this is a dimensionless number you can go and is the dimensionless parameter that's constrained by WMAP, for instance. And so WMAP tell you that FNL is less than 134 or something. 134. So this is 10. So there's a lot. So, but the point I should. So you might naively. So your best guess might be that it's of order one, in that the second order non-Gaussian effect would be the square of the first order bit, and that's the generic assumption in the inflaton scenario, is that it would be something like that. But already, that's a statement that the non-Gaussianity is very small, right? Because this is 10 to the minus 5, and this is the square of 10 to the minus 5. So if this were as big as this, this would have to be 10 to the 5. So 134 is quite a... So in that sense, 134 is a strong constraint. So for the curvaton, delta rho over rho, I told you, is something like omega in the chi field when it decays times delta chi over... of rho chi over rho chi, and it's just, I'm thinking of it as just being a scalar field in a quadratic potential. So this is omega chi times delta chi over chi, plus the term, the second order term is basically delta chi over chi all squared. So it fits in with that picture, except for the definition of used here is, if I actually try and write it in this form, so delta rho 1 is this, and then I've got something times the square of that, but of course the something now, to make it all work out, I've got to put in a 1 over omega at the decay time. So, but you end up seeing that FNL is basically telling you 1 over how much omega, how much the curvaton contributed at the decay time. So if you measure the non-Gaussianity, you measure this coefficient in the expression, bigger than less than 134 means that omega at the decay time is bigger than about 1%. So the universe, the curvaton has to contribute at least 1% to the energy density when it decays. And in the limit that it dominates at the decay time, FNL goes back to being of order 1 and probably never measurable.
But 1%
corresponds to what energy scale? Well, 1% here. It's this dimensionless number. It really is omega in the curvaton at decay time. So it's not, doesn't tell you automatically about the energy scale. That would depend on its actual mass or its actual decay rate.
They don't also, that's the non-Gaussian.
So this is how the non-Gaussian constraint turns up here. The isocurvature tells you that you have to go down different branches in the physics. If the curvaton is nothing to do with the generation of the baryon number, then you will get you'll get no isocurvature perturbation. If the curvaton produces the baryon number, then you end up with a constraint which is something like the photon to baryon number is, and I think it's 1 minus omega over omega chi times the curvature perturbation. I've been calling this R or zeta, curvature and isocurvature. So the fact that this is bigger than 1% tells. So in those models, you've got this number is. So mod s from observations is less than about r. So this number has to be less than about 1. So in these models, omega chi has to be of order unity. I forget the exact number. You can turn it into a number. But it actually turns out to mean that the non-Gaussianity is not significant in those models, where the baryon number is linked to the curvaton decay. The baryon asymmetry is linked to the curvaton decay.
Okay, this R is what you get from the inflaton itself.
Yeah.
Because that would be instructive. I mean, since the delta chi and the delta phi are of the same order, right? H over 2 pi.
Yeah, yes. That's,
in the case of the inflaton, you have to divide by some slow parameter.
That's right.
So does that mean that in order for this to be the relevant perturbation, you need chi small?
That's one way, certainly one way to do it. R from the at horizon crossing from the inflaton. What is it in terms of V and V primed, or V over slow roll parameter root epsilon? So you can play around, you know. So in the inflaton case, you have this, the whole curvaton scenario. If it's driven by a slow roll scalar field, and we don't, in the curvaton, it doesn't. Like in some sense, I could say it doesn't have to be like that. But on the other hand, I don't have any other model to give you for to drive the expansion of the universe. Then there is a fluctuation. Then in slow roll inflation, there is a fluctuation from the inflaton. Usually, you fit it to be of 10 to the minus 5. Here, it has to be less than 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah, but I wanted to understand the place of the two. I mean, because delta phi and delta chi are about the same, right?
Yes, that's right. Delta phi and delta chi are the same. So you could compare the VEV. Yeah, so you've got to compare the VEV with this sort of ratio. Or, okay, so if, you know, you could rewrite this if you wanted to as delta phi over h, so the h is sort of part of this. You have to look at all your tuning, the other constraints you fit, and instead of fitting a value, you just say you have to make it less than that value. So whether that's easier or harder, so it's a construct.
Like, instead of the inflaton mass 10 to the 13 GeV, you make it 10 to the 12 GeV.
Yeah, 10 to the 12th, but now 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 10 will all work. So it may have been harder to make the mass small, but at least, you know, it's the whole regime below that value. Okay, so maybe I should just briefly finish both, giving a little airtime to the modulated reheating scenario here. But that's on my notes. It's just the statement that reheating may be a function of some field other than the reheating rate may be a function of some field other than the inflaton, and it's so this is based on really the old model of reheating before people got interested in preheating and other such things, where you assume that the inflaton's decay as it oscillates about its minimum at the end of inflation, there's a decay rate gamma. And the modulated reheating picture is just the statement that gamma could be some function of some other field chi that was light during inflation. So where again, delta chi squared is h over, has some fluctuations during inflation at horizon crossing. And the picture then is that you should work out the effect of that on the final density perturbation. In the sort of picture I was drawing of constructing uniform expansion hypersurfaces, the decay rate along this world line and this world line, you assume could be different. the decay rate you can read off, one way to interpret it as being that you have a universe dominated by an oscillating scalar field up until some point when the inflaton decays and it then becomes radiation. So it's sort of a dust equation of state here and then radiation. Same thing happens here, but there's the time interval between in here and here may be different. So when you calculate the density perturbation resulting from expansion N1 to N2, this is dust, this is radiation. So the equations you're using, the local equations are -3 h rho here, but here it becomes -4 h rho. And, the basic statement is that you produce a density perturbation on the final surface, assuming that there was no density perturbation at N1. At N2, you end up with a density perturbation which is given by that variation in the decay rate relative to the average decay rate. So that's just very... and you can work out the numbers in terms of this sort of instant decay approximation. And you get the sort of specific coefficients that are quoted in the papers. So, the final point being then, of course, this is gamma is a function of chi, right? So the statement is that now this is determined by delta chi relative to its VEV. And you have similar results, extra effects coming in. For instance, you can calculate the non-Gauss. If gamma is not just a linear function of chi, but there's some quadratic correction, you can calculate the amplitude of the non-Gaussian correction here in a similar way to what I showed for the curvaton. So in this model, so just the sort of general comment about the difference between this and the curvaton case in terms of the physics, the curvaton is based on the notion of the curvaton being a weakly coupled field. So you always have to be in that limit that everything's weakly coupled, which is at least consistent with scale invariant spectrum during inflation. This reheating case, of course, the curvaton the chi field and the inflaton have to be coupled. And as we've seen before in studies of reheating at the end of inflation, there is a tension between keeping a scale invariant, a weakly coupled scalar field with a scale invariant spectrum during inflation, and then having a large enough coupling to have an effect during, say, reheating. This has been investigated a lot in the case of preheating, where you actually required a very strong coupling. Perhaps that's the sort of thing which needs to be investigated now in these models of modulated reheating, as to whether you can have an effect at the end of inflation and still have a scale invariant spectrum, a weakly coupled field during inflation. So, this is not my model, so I've not spent much time talking about it. But that's just to give a flavor of what's going on there. And there I should probably finish, just say that these models are examples where the physics, by considering the inflaton scenario is based simply on conservation of energy. You relate quantities calculated along a unique trajectory during inflation to the late time adiabatic density perturbation. These models involve more, these scenarios involve more physics. You have to, there's more that goes into calculating the amplitude of the final amplitude of the perturbations. It's not determined just by the geometry. You have to do some of the physics now. That makes it interesting in the sense of making a connection with particle physics, but it also makes these more complicated in terms of the phenomenology, which is maybe why it's just not been considered. For the first 20 years, people have played around with simple models of the origin of structure, and now we're getting more sophisticated. Sorry.
Is there anything you see in the data?
There is no observational problem with the inflaton scenario. When we started working on the curvaton model, I was saying that the relation, for instance, between the baryon and the isocurvature perturbation and the curvature perturbation seemed like a lovely prediction to make. It's just that the data's got too good. So you end up working, placing constraints on the model. Both of them can produce, in fact, any of these are designed to, in one limit, to produce purely adiabatic, purely scale invariant density perturbations. And if we're in that limit, you can't, from the observations, tell them apart. But these do have, well, as I say, things like isocurvature perturbations or non-Gaussianity offer signals of something more than just the standard inflaton scenario. I think the other thing I should say is that gravitational waves, significant amplitude of gravitational waves, is only consistent with the inflaton scenario. So we may not see them, but if we did, that would push you towards the inflaton scenario. So,
but why is that? Is that obvious?
Well, in general terms, it's because we assume in these models that the adiabatic mode, that is the scalar curvature perturbation actually produced at horizon crossing, is negligible. And if that's negligible, you actually have consistency relations that tell you that the, at least in slow roll, what we understand of slow roll inflation, the tensor modes must be small as well. So there are some very general statements you can make like that, I think. Yes, sir.
What does the curvatron scenario do for the scale of inflation? Can you bring the scale
down? Yeah, so you can follow through the statement that the gravitational waves must be negligible. That immediately says that the energy scale for inflation must be well below 10 to the 15, 16 GeV. So you're forced to be relatively low. I mean, both the inflaton and the curvaton scenario can then go to low energy scales. So not seeing gravitational waves, for instance, doesn't actually tell you where you are. but it does, yeah.
Consistency relation might not actually tell you the tensor wave. It's more because it could be that it's not really slow rolling at all. And it will be just fine.
Yes, that's the sort of interesting possibility which you can sort of think about, but is that maybe in these scenarios you don't need the inflaton to produce the large scale structure, so maybe you don't need a slow rolling inflaton to drive inflation. That said, I haven't read the paper by Shamit and Dvalli, but I think they're trying to play that game a bit. You could have some, there's models like thermal inflation, for instance, with bursts of inflation which are not slow roll. Then maybe the inflaton isn't light, although you don't have a light inflaton field. Maybe then you have to go to these kinds of models. It becomes a possibility you can try and work with, but there hasn't.
Actually, a similar model can work in preheating scenario. It just restores symmetry because of low frequency fluctuations which you produce during inflation. So then, in this model, you may also generate fluctuations different way.
Yeah, yeah. So there's.
At every step, you make a special medal for next stage of baroqueness and the next stage.
That's right. There are models of non-slow roll inflation, I suppose. So one can consider these possibilities there.
You give a flat spectrum for your curve.
Well, you have to be careful as you go away from slow roll. If there's significant dynamical evolution during inflation, that does affect the curvaton spectrum as well, because H becomes a function of time.
So you have to be careful
there. Yeah, I mean, some of these models actually are basically, you can be trapped in a false vacuum for a brief period. And then, well, you have to, it may be that H is almost constant for a short period there. So, but there are constraints. You can work out, in terms of, there are parameters where you can work out the slope of the curvaton spectrum and relate that to how H changes during inflation, for instance. So there's a whole new game in town, basically, to play with parameter constraints from the observations. OK, I should finish there.